Chapter 12. Malachurst. They did not chain him. He supposed that act was a measure of respect. His cell was a complex of rooms in the Black Levels. The vastness of the vengeful spirit meant that there were sections of Hull that rarely felt the steps of feet, and some that, through disuse or old battle damage, were left lightless and without power or air. Even with the ship fully operational, the momentum of conquest always left places that it was simpler to seal off than repair. These volumes of darkness were like dead flesh in the body of the ship, he thought sometimes, haunted by the scars of old battles. Malachurst had used some of these airless mazes himself in the past. There was always a need for places out of sight and mind. Now he found himself a prisoner of one. They had let him have his armour, of course, but had drained it of almost all power, so that his limping walk was a slow plod. If he, say, tried to smash through one of the armoured bulkheads that closed him in, he would drain its reserves before he even made a dent, and then he would be left with nothing to do but breathe. They had even locked a collar around his throat inside the armour. It was brass, spiked on the inside, and, he was told, able to sense disturbances in the warp. If he tried to use sorcery, it would drive the spikes into his neck until they met in the middle. He wondered where Axemand had got it from. The deck trembled, and kept trembling. Malachurst paused, counting as the rumbling vibration continued.
Sustained firing, he thought.
The ship was unleashing its full weapon manifold.
Pride, he breathed to himself as he trudged down a lightless corridor.
He had walked the entire volume of the sealed space three times in different patterns, and had found no possible way out, not even a means of communicating with the rest of the ship. Even if he could, though, who could he trust? He thought of the way that Sutta Nul had left his side just before he had gone to the Strategium. A sign of betrayal, or a coincidence? He did not know which. But Axemand had suspected something. Poor, doubting, fearful, and fierce little Horus. He'd always had flaws, but Malachurst had not expected this.
You were warned,
came a thought, in a voice that sounded like Amarok's.
We should talk.
The voice was a chorus of knife tips scraped over metal in Malachurst's mind. Frost spread over the walls and floor, sparkling in the glow of his helm's eyepieces. A static charge tingle ran over his skin. Tormageddon stepped into view, its form seeming to coalesce from the dark. Its head was bare, its face powdered with ice crystals. It was smiling the fixed smile of a jackal. Sharp teeth, white in red gums. Its eyes were clouded pearl, with shattered amber irises and slit pupils. Its hands were empty at its sides.
Talk,
said Malachurst carefully. The demon host halted. Not for the first time, Malachurst wondered at the nature of the demon he had helped draw into Grail Noctua's flesh. He had helped create the creature, providing the body in which it could walk the world. But he had not bound it to his will. The Lupercai that he had created were creatures of twin souls, mergers of legion flesh and demon thing, hybrids of being. Tormageddon was not that. As far as he could tell, nothing remained of the hosts it had taken. All that remained of Grail Noctua were the traces of his features beneath the demon's touch, and the demon itself, it claimed to be a thing formed from the husk of dead Torgadon's soul, a revenant born of the culling of the Legion at Istvan, from the warp ripples created by that act of betrayal. Was that true? Could that be true? Malachurst had doubts enough not to trust it, even though Horus had exalted it by placing it in his council. Who did the demon serve, and to what end? Now, more than ever, the question seemed most in need of an answer. Malachurst looked around the dark passages.
Is your visit sanctioned by the others?
I go where I will, replied the demon host.
I've heard that before.
Tormageddon shrugged, the strangely fluid movement sending frost dust falling to the floor.
Little Horus does not have the means to stop me if he tried.
What side are you on, creature?
Asked Malachurst. Tormageddon tilted its head as though in question.
You know of what I speak, demon.
Tormageddon raised its head, still smiling its needle smile.
Your fickle kind will see us lose this war, said Malachurst. We'll see the War Master fail on the point of victory.
Would it surprise you, Malachurst, if I said I did not care?
Malachurst held its amber stare, and then shook his head.
No, it would not.
I just want to ask you a question, Malachurst.
The voice hissed at the edges, as though it had been whispered by several throats.
Why do you care?
The War Master.
You are a man who has power. Subtlety.
It moved forwards, raising its hand to trace the remains of Noctua's features with its fingers.
Ruthlessness. Yet you do not thirst for your own ends. You have the soul of a lord, and yet bind yourself as a servant. Why?
Malachurst blinked for a second, and in the corner of his mind he saw the fire painting the walls of the mine cave with the shadows of the gangers. Laughter pulled mouths back into wolf grins. He smelled the tang of ore dust and cinders, the smell of a home left far behind.
For reasons that are my own, he said.
The demon host was watching him, its pupils black razor slits in its eyes.
You will do anything to see him win this war,
it said.
You know that I will.
Tormageddon nodded once.
Yes,
it replied.
I do know. The question is, are you willing to let others pay the same price?
What do you mean?
War, Malachurst. War and murder.
Malachurst blinked again, and in the slice of time saw the demon Amarok wearing Iacton Cruz's face. The parchment pinned to his chest, the word murder glistening wet and red.
You think you can bring Horus back? Can help him win the war within him?
I can.
Perhaps. But you need to move out from the shadows and put aside your spider's ways for a time. Aximand will not let you do as you intend out of ignorance, and Kyber will not let you out of fear. Abaddon is not here to take the cause either way. So you are left here, chained in the dark, while Lupercal withers in dreams, and you can do nothing.
He must submit. Is that what you came here for?
Malachurst snarled.
To offer an observation of futility?
No. I came to see if you would accept my offer to give you command of the Legion.
The ship shook again in the silence. The recoil of guns and the impact of munitions trembled through Malachurst as the demon's words hung in his skull. He shook his head.
We are a legion,
he said.
We are the War Master's sons. We do not turn on each other.
Yes, we do,
said the demon. The voice was a dry rasp, using withered vocal cords, but it was recognizable. It was not the blade rasp of the demon's thought voice, nor the lilting growl of Grail Noctua. It was the voice of Torgadon, half a decade dead on the pyre of Istvan III.
Kyber and Aximand are loyal to Lupercal. They are...
They are in the way. What do you want, Malachurst? To help your War Master, or to let loyalty to an ideal you helped murder stay your hand?
Murder. The word caught again in his thoughts.
It will need care.
What does not?
He looked at the demon's eyes.
What power do you serve that you would help me so, creature?
My ends are my own.
And that answer worries me more than anything else,
he thought.
Very well, brother,
he said.
We have an agreement. Let war and murder be done.
The demon's smile was still in the mask of its face as it bowed its head. Lyak. The palace, which was a city, wept as they processed through it. Cries of pain and loss and joy tumbled and echoed down the roads. Figures, some human, many not, flung themselves at their feet, pleading in hisses before cutting their own throats. Most continued to babble as their blood spread over the pure white marble. All of them had been crying before they died, Lyak noted. The sounds rose up the walls of the buildings and flowed back down, the noise deafening. Figures watched them pass from delicate balconies projecting from the side of the smooth-sided towers. Mutants, with the heads of bulls and bodies of oiled muscle, huffed and snorted, brandishing hook-bladed swords and fists of razor chains. Bloated heaps of flesh in sheaths of silk and velvet chattered in a high, brittle tongue that Lyak had never heard. Amongst them, the Neverborn moved, sliding between forms, lithe, languid, toothed and clawed, caressing and stinging the mortals at whim. Lyak's mind blurred with the beat of the warp-saturated air. He could no longer pick apart what was crafted of thought or matter. The two had merged, as interchangeable as song or speech.
"We are being watched," said Actea.
"Of course we are," replied Lorgar.
No one had stopped them entering. Indeed, he had not seen any gates or structures that could be called fortifications. But the threat he felt increased with every step.
"No," said Actea. "I do not mean demons or sorcery. There are forces watching us. I can feel them."
"I know," said Lorgar.
Actea did not reply. Their path led up and up, curving around towers and circling domes of brightly coloured glass and polished silver. Lyak could detect the geometry of the Eldar in their lines, but minutely altered, as though the mind that had guided the hand that had made every tower, pillar, and door had intended a subtle mockery and insult. Every wall was softly curved, the angles pulling in the eye, and not releasing it until it had guided it to a statue of pearl, a pool of water floating with towers, a flayed figure hanging in a web of bell-hung chains, its moans a perfect discord with the chimes. Occasionally, they crossed a span between two structures and looked down on a canal of clear water or a road choked with bodies, winged demons squatting amongst the carcasses, lips and hands red.
"What path are we following?"
asked Lyak. A demon looked up at him and refolded its flayed skin wings. Actea looked at him, but then looked away.
"None," said Lorgar. "But we will reach Fulgrim. He will be where he always is when it is his choice. At the center of things. He just wants to show off first."
As Lorgar spoke, they came into a wide piazza. Statues of alabaster, marble, and jade ringed it, each figure perfect at a glance, but more monstrous the closer one looked. Water chuckled into the air from gold fountainheads in the shape of perfect human men and women. Lyak saw wide bloodshot eyes staring out from the sockets of one of the statues, and thought he heard a gagged silent scream in his mind. A crowd filled the open space. Bright silks flowed in the warm breeze. Masked faces turned to look at them, sorrow and joy in jewels and velvet. The crowd parted as they walked forwards. Willow-thin figures in pink tunics appeared from amongst the press and scattered grey flower petals and ashes into the air. Lyak saw that all of them had either eyes or mouths or a nose or ears, but never more than one.
Aurelian, 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 they sang.
The ashen petals settled on the ground before their feet as they walked on. A spindle-thin dancer, clad in purple, spun across their path. A horned mask hid its face, but it held up a hand to them. Lorgar halted, Lyak and the rest behind him. The dancer bowed, laughed, and then cartwheeled to the side, and behind it the last of the crowd parted like a curtain before a stage. A figure lay on a dais before them. It was bloated, its flesh hanging in soft rolls from its torso. Lyak could see tiny, podgy hands protruding from the folds of fat. Its lower body was serpentine. Pearlescent scales covered the coiled mass. Scales peeled back to show green eyes. A small head, its features sunken into flesh, sat atop the mass of its body, a long spill of white hair hanging from its scalp. Splashes of blood and dark liquid that might have been wine mottled its skin. It shifted as they approached, its bulk bursting cushions. The crowd nearest it was trembling. Some were eating their own flesh. Blood spattered the white stone beneath their feet.
Lorgar,
it hissed as they approached, the word forming patterns of writhing smoke as it left its lips. Three of the word-bearers had fallen to their knees. Others were swaying like reeds in a breeze. It was vile. Lyak had looked on the amassed horrors of the warp, had bound them and carried out deeds to earn their favour, but to even look at the heaped mass on the dais was to feel one's soul stretched and siphoned off, to feel every denied desire rise from the recesses of dreams. He recognised it, even though he had never seen it. It was a most sacred abomination, and he had never felt a stronger desire to reduce it to molten fat and burnt skin. It was also not Fulgrim. He turned to Lorgar, words forming on his tongue, but the thing on the dais spoke again.
Welcome,
it said, the words shivering through its body. It smiled, pink lips pulling back over bladed teeth red with blood and wine. The tiny hands hanging from its torso flexed.
Welcome to my city, my realm, my world, brother mine.
Lorgar stared at the thing, his face expressionless in its serenity. No, he said. This is not your city, demon. He turned to look around at the whimpering and laughing crowd.
Show yourself, Fulgrim.
The bloated creature on the dais hissed like a cat, and a rattle-tipped tail rose into the air from its coils.
It is well, my sweet,
said a voice like honey. The purple-clad dancer somersaulted forwards, bowed low, then swept the mask from its face and snapped into a perfect high salute. The arm holding the mask raised above its head, weight balanced on the points of its toes.
My brother simply cannot take a joke,
said Fulgrim, and giggled.
Not even a small one.
The face of the dancer shone with perfection. Every line and feature was the truth that sculptors had reached for in the greatest works of art and failed to grasp. He peeled the velvet from his head, and ice-white hair spilled out, catching in the breeze and billowing out behind him. He glided closer to Lorgar, growing in size with every step, so that he stood eye to eye with the Primarch of the Word-Bearers. A smile hooked the edge of his mouth up over ivory teeth.
Brother, he said, I hope that this will be pleasant.
Lorgar remained silent. Fulgrim shrugged, the gesture like a ripple of wind.
Maybe that is too much to hope for.
He turned away, and Lyak caught the flash of a silver dagger in Fulgrim's hand. He surged forwards, pulling the blade slaves with him. But Fulgrim brought the blade down across his own torso. The velvet parted and fell away from alabaster muscle. The demon Primarch stepped out of the fallen suit, and as his bare foot touched stone, it changed. Scales spread up his leg, sheathing his flesh as it swelled. His other leg was gone, vanished into the serpent coils that grew beneath him as he slid forwards. A second set of arms reached out from the side of his torso. Rings glittered on the fingers, winking like flaring stars. Fulgrim reached the dais and flowed up its side. The bloated thing squirmed in greeting, uncoiling its bulk and twining it around Fulgrim as he embraced it. The thing purred up at the demon Primarch, baring its teeth. Fulgrim ran a hand over its hair.
There, Unkari, my delight. We will have bliss again once this is done with. But he's family, and that means I should listen to what he says, At least a little.
Unkari. It was not its true name. That was a thing that would have broken reality to speak. But in the realm of the warp, it was like a signature drawn in atrocity. Lyak had glimpsed it and heard it at the edge of bloody visions, but never seen it before. Now it sat before him. Unkari, eater of delight, the son of ruin, the daughter of delight, one of the six courtesans of the Dark Prince. Fulgrim settled next to the exalted demon, their snake bodies intertwining with a sigh, then turned his gaze back on Lorgar. A hush fell over the piazza, before flowing out into the city. Screams and songs strangled in throats. Gongs and flutes fell silent.
So,
he said, and the smile had gone from his face.
What shall we talk about?
Argonis. Argonis entered Perturabo's audience chamber as the Ironblood moved to the edge of the Sarum system. A layer of metallic dust covering the floor spoke to the chamber's abandonment. Argonis had last stood here when the Ironblood sat in the orbit of Talarn. Perturabo had not used the chamber since the close of that campaign. He shunned it for its association with humiliation, Argonis suspected. But now it had a new use. Volk stood at the foot of the throne, still and silent.
If it is still Volk, thought Argonis.
Either way, he wanted to know. Argonis had detected no breath or beating hearts as he entered the throne room, and Volk gave no sign of being aware that he was there. Volk did know he was there. Argonis could feel that truth in the prickle of threat running down his spine as he stepped closer to the thing that had been his friend. The Iron Warrior's body no longer looked like that of a legionary, augmented or not. It no longer looked like anything that had started as human. He had grown. The metal of his armor and augmentations had taken on a smooth, flesh-like texture. Steel sinews stretched between plates, arms bulged like ripe fruit, skinned in gunmetal. Volk's head sat in the helmet socket, bare, the remaining flesh pale and threaded with dark veins. The augmetics grafted to his skull after his injury had sunk into the flesh, flowing to match the shape of lost bone, so that now two-thirds of his face was a steel skull. His eyes were shut. The closed lids still looked like flesh. Argonis looked at him for several minutes. He knew what the War Master's allies were. He had seen Horus unleash those allies in person. He had stood with the Lupercai, seen men like Malachurst and Telecrae rip the life from the living with a word. He knew the name that was given to those allies, and knew that it was a truth. Demons. They had brought the creatures of old myth back to destroy the Emperor's Age of Illumination. And that did not trouble him. In such a conflict, there could be no limits on how war was waged. He did not exist to doubt or question. He was the War Master's will. That was what he had decided after Istvan, after his moment of weakness. But here he was looking at something that he could not place into that scheme of honour and oaths.
Volk, he said, the word vanishing into the empty dark.
Brother, can you hear me?
No reply came. Volk might have been a statue, or a corpse. He let out a breath. His hands, always steady, fidgeted to the grip of his pistol. Legion, he said, blinking as the word came from his lips. Brotherhood. Loyalty. It's simple, isn't it? So simple. Even when you're killing each other, you just redraw the lines. You hold on to the words, but give them a different edge. Legion becomes those who follow the War Master's vision. Brotherhood becomes those who have dipped their hands in the same blood. Loyalty becomes... His voice trailed off. He had drawn his bolt pistol. It was Martian-made, and marked with the memories of Chthonia. Gang runes glinted in the claws of the eagle that spread its wings in gold on the casing, and a mirror coin had been worked into the pistol butt. It was the weapon of a gang warlord, a mark of status, a tool of execution. He hesitated, black gaze fixed on the closed eyes in the steel skull. He raised the pistol. The barrel was level with the closed right eye. His finger tightened on the trigger. The eye opened. Argonis's trigger finger froze. The eye was silver from edge to edge. He fired as Volk's hand clamped over the pistol barrel. The bolt tore into the palm. Shreds of metal scattered out. Argonis flinched back as shrapnel kissed his face. Volk stepped forward, still gripping the pistol. His hand was a torn ruin. Blood fell to the floor, hissing from red to chrome. But he did not let go. Tendrils of metal coiled over the pistol. The metal of the housing began to glow red. Argonis let go, hand going to his sword. Volk raised the weapon. His arm was swelling, swallowing the gun like tar swallowing a stone. Argonis had his sword free. It lit with a crackle of activating power. Volk looked at the weapon. Lightning danced in the mirrors of his eyes. He raised his hand. The fluid mass was hardening into cold metal. Firing mechanisms grew, ejection ports opened, and a gun barrel sprouted. Argonis looked into the black circle of the muzzle. It was the perfect diameter for a bolt pistol. He could see rifling spiraling down the inside into the dark beyond. On the casing behind it, an eagle in gold flowed into being, then set. Argonis looked beyond the gun, his drawn sword raised but still. Volk was staring at him. Unreadable. Then his arm snapped back. Argonis watched as the gun welded to his hand broke apart, disassembling and dissolving in a heartbeat. Volk's empty hand remained. He stepped back into the same position and posture he had been in before. Argonis lowered his sword but kept it lit. Volk's eyes were still open.
"Did you choose this, brother?" he asked,
surprised as the question came from his mouth.
"Did you choose to become this?"
Volk remained silent, then looked up as though he had heard something. He nodded to himself and closed his eyes, and the klaxons began to howl. Argonis swore and ran for the doors, clamping on his helm as he moved. Data flooded his senses as he reconnected to the strategic feed. It took him 5 seconds to assimilate the approximation of the situation, and in that time he was already 100 meters away and sprinting for the strategium. Blast doors peeled open in front of him, and guards and gun pods stood down as they read his clearance.
"How many now?"
he called as he entered the strategium. Perturabo stood at the center of his curtain of screens and hollow displays.
20.
Replied Forex.
"I've just exited the warp at the system edge. Largest displacement is 1/3 our mass, but they're coming on fast. Auspex confirms they're at full battle readiness."
"Of course they are," thought Argonis.
The 13th Legion was always battle ready. He looked at where a smaller tactical image flickered on the officer's screen. 20 ships were running through the void, splitting into 4 clusters as they came on. Names and tactical information scrawled beside the display. Catullus, Agentha-class strike cruiser. Truth of Honor, Credo-class strike corvette. Sword of the 500, Megaron-class strike cruiser, and so on. The details plucked from the honor rolls of the Great Crusade. Argonis clamped his teeth shut over a rising stream of Chthonian invective. How had the Ultramarines got this far this fast? They were far beyond the front made by Gilliman's secondary forces, but the outer edge of the 13th Legion's battlegroups was supposed to be weeks of travel and months of fighting away. But the display did not lie. They were here. By ill luck or design, they were here.
"They'll not be able to defeat us," said Forex.
"The relative force factors up." "They do not need to defeat us," snapped Argonis. "They just need to delay us." The Iron Warrior looked as though he was about to argue. "It's a vanguard fleet," said Argonis, straightening. The memory of Volk's cold, calm eyes flashed in his mind. He breathed out. "They don't need to defeat us because coming just behind them is a full Ultramarines assault fleet." He looked up at Perturabo. The Primarch returned his gaze through the hollow projections. "We know where Angron is," said Argonis. "The War Master's will is not that we stand and fight here. We should run." Perturabo's weapon mounts clattered. His eyes were black spheres, sparkling with the curtain of raw data falling past him. Argonis remembered the flash of reflected lightning in Volk's eyes. "Did you choose this, brother?"
"I am the red in your blood."
"And the edge of your blade, Lord of Iron," said the memory of the demon's voice.
Perturabo was perfectly still for a second, and then seemed to shiver.
"We run," he said.